Hi, everybody. I'm Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. Boy, the people listening to that CD will wonder what was so funny about that. Thank you, Lee, for that great introduction. I was wondering who he was talking about there at the end. And thank all of you for being here, and the folks that put this conference together, from David and Jerry and all the people were there at the beginning, to certainly Sarah and Carol, who have just been so sweet leading up to it. And speaking of Sarah, I really agree with Rick's assessment of the dress. However, I wasn't overall surprised, because over the last year, I have become convinced of Sarah's ability to be repetitive about things. I'm not a bit surprised, but everybody is so wonderful, and really the spirit of this conference is just absolutely off the chart. The geography around us and the people and the spirit of recovery is just wonderful, and from a personal standpoint, I've absolutely loved Ralph and Hilda and Rick. It's been just great, and I've seen some people that I've loved for a long time, like Beverly and Ellen and some others, and Jerry over there has been one of my AA heroes ever since I've been sober, practically, and run into some folks from Louisville, Kentucky. In fact, Chuck back there has got a Louisville connection, and after a workshop this morning, he was talking to Sharon, my wife, who is this lovely redheaded woman up here in the front row. And Chuck said to Sharon, said, do you know the guy that's speaking tonight? He's from Louisville. And I think Sharon said, sometimes I think I might, but other times I don't. So just thank everybody for being here for me so that I can have another day of sobriety. And, you know, when we talk about being grateful, I have long come to the conclusion that that nice, warm feeling of gratitude, that's not gratitude. That's the reward for gratitude. Gratitude is action. It's doing those things when I don't want to do them. It's sponsoring the absolutely unlovely. It's when I don't have time at all, and when every fiber of my being wants to tell that receptionist, for God's sake, tell him I'll call him back. But taking a deep breath and praying, that will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. And say to the receptionist, put him through, and say, good morning, buddy. How are you? What can I do for you? It's doing the things around my home group that you'd think a big circuit speaker like me ought not have to, by George. It's doing those things that I don't want to do. When I'm grateful for Sharon, sitting around and feeling all warm and fuzzy inside and grateful for Sharon doesn't do Sharon much good. It's doing things for her when I don't feel like doing them, when I don't want to do them. That's my gratitude for Sharon. And that results in that nice, warm feeling of gratitude. And I'll tell you the first thing I'm grateful for tonight, the very first thing I'm grateful for, is the unbelievable gift of another day of life. You know, this is magic. Life is magic. We human beings are magic creatures. My goodness, we've got these eyes, and we've got these hands, and we've got the ability to see one another and communicate. It is all magic. And every day that my God gives me the gift of that, the details like money and what's going on with the different personal relationships and that sort of thing, really, if I can get it in perspective, don't matter a whole lot. Because if you take all the days that have come and gone before I came on this earth, and all the ones that are going to come and go after I leave this earth, and do the math, this day of life is a greater victory than winning Powerball. It truly is. Mathematically, this day of life is a greater victory than winning Powerball. Now, I'll tell you, I've given you this high-minded talk here on that and have no idea why I started out that way, but let me also tell you this. At 29 years old, and by the way, by the grace of God, my sobriety day is April 9th, 1981, and if any of your historians out there, you may recognize the historical significance of that. That is Appomattox Day. That's the day that General Lee surrendered. So I threw down my sword 116 years to the day after General Lee. And my home group is the Calm Down group right across the river from downtown Louisville. And when we started it 20 years ago, I named it. And it so meets on Wednesdays. And believe me, by Wednesday, I normally need to calm down. So even though I know all those wonderful things about this gift of life, here's what I still do if I don't watch myself. I will throw that gift back in God's face because I don't like the way it's wrapped. I will absolutely forfeit a precious day of life because I don't like the wrapping on it. And that's such a cheating of myself when I do it. And I'm so grateful I'm sober, and I'm so grateful that you folks are here for me, and that for whatever reason, God has seen fit to put me up here. Jerry and I were talking at lunch. Neither one of us have ever sent a message anywhere. We think you need a spiritual revival and we need to come talk. The only reason that I'm up here is real simple. Somebody asked me. And thank you so much for asking me. Now, I got some good news and bad news. The bad news is we're going to need a lot of divine intervention over the next several minutes here. And the good news is I've found out that it's pretty darned easy to get when I'll stick close to you folks who are the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and to these 12 steps that are the only program of recovery I know of that we've got around here. And the first place I'm thinking of we're going to need divine intervention is we're going to need it to get me out of the way. I used to stand up to give a talk and say, if I can get me out of the way, I'm going to do this or that. I want to tell you something. If I could get me out of the way, I could have stayed in Louisville. You know, I wouldn't need meetings. I wouldn't need any of this stuff. Getting me out of the way is absolutely as impossible for me right tonight as it was in April of 1981. I have got to have divine intervention to get me out of the way. Next place I'm thinking of we're going to need it, we're really going to need it here, is I'm going to try to follow directions. Now, I've got a long and sad history with the directions. You folks that have been sober a long time probably won't be surprised by this, but my case is different. Always has been. There's a little fella inside me, and he and I are the world's greatest experts on everything. Whether we know anything about it or not is totally beside the point. And we're not only so knowledgeable, my goodness, we are sophisticated and worldly. We know how the world works. First place, we know who makes the directions. Square Johns. Button-down conservative Square Johns. And they're usually being advised by lawyers who are worse than they are. And we know the purpose of directions. It's to manipulate idiots into doing things. So obviously, in a special case like mine, you have to sort of extrapolate in order to figure out what the directions really mean. And I'm fortunate, I suppose, because that's never been any trouble. In fact, without divine intervention, I'm normally not aware of it. But I assure you that if I haven't done the work I need to do today to get my divine intervention, and I've found out over the years that I seem to get very little divine intervention on Thursday based on what I did on Wednesday. It's a day-at-a-time deal. And if I haven't done what I need to do to get it, if, for instance, I see some directions that say something like, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, my brain will record that as really meaning something like, do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. So we're going to need some divine intervention. And the directions I hope to follow for a little while are first the ones we hear all the time, a little bit about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. And there's another set of directions in the book that we don't talk about as much. The book says that our personal stories tell in our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our Creator. And I really hope that my story carries that. Because when I was first exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I'll tell you a little about in a minute, and as Lee mentioned, I did not come here because it gave me the hiccups. And when I was first exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was closed to the idea of God does not begin to describe it. I was allergic to the God thing. And when you mentioned God, it insulted my intellect and made the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. And as far as you talking about higher power, you weren't fooling me. You were trying to backdoor me on that God crap. I think it made me madder. So that kept running me out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so blessed because I was allowed to live long enough and get run back in here and by alcohol enough times because I didn't have anywhere else to go. Until finally in April 1981, the biggest miracle that has ever happened, or I'm convinced will ever happen in my life, happened. I was given the first little bit of teachability or humility I've ever had in my life. I was given the first willingness to start doing some things that I did not understand, that I did not agree with, that I did not think would work, and I certainly did not want to do those things. And if it had not been for that gift, as Lee mentioned, I would have been rotting in a pauper's grave somewhere around Nashville, Tennessee, for way more than 29 years. Biggest gift that I ever got in my life. So I hope that my story carries that, because without that, I wouldn't be standing here. I'd be in that grave. I grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, and probably the most informative thing I can tell you about my early life is that it wasn't a thing like I thought it was. My capacity for self-delusion is astounding, and if I haven't done the work I need to do today to get my divine intervention, it is totally intact. I am just as capable of self-delusion as I was in April 1981. And I was 37 when I got sober. And up until that point, I know that I would have passed any lie detector test on earth. When I told you the saga, it transcended a story. It was a saga, and my God, it was interesting and romantic. And, of course, it was all about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached in life. And I believed that crap so sincerely that I would usually have you and me both crying before I was halfway done telling it. And I wasn't sober a week before I realized, man, it was a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't anywhere close to poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and really most of the things we wanted. And those heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. My alcoholism is truly many, many things. I call it sometimes a many-splendored thing. And I really believe, also call it a hydra sometimes. Seems like I cut off one head and another one appears. But I believe that every fiber of my being is alcoholic. And it's many different things. And one of those things is something that Ms. Wallace, my high school English teacher, would have called a disease of superlatives. And what that means is that without divine intervention, I won't think in terms of things like good and bad. And ordinary won't ever cross my mind. I'll think in terms of best, worst, just the absolute extremes of everything. And I'll give you forewarning, as Jerry and I would call it a caveat, which means you really can't rely on the thing I say. But the caveat is that I am sure that I've been a whole lot more just ordinary garden variety, both drunk and sober, than my ego's ever been able to stand. What was really going on the first 12, 13 years wasn't any of that. It was the selfishness and self-centeredness that the book talks about. Book says that's the root of our troubles. And for many years, I have believed that what that means to me is that I've got a disorder of my ego. And I've had it all my life. I had it long before I had the mental obsession with alcohol, long before the physical allergy to alcohol was a factor, long before any of the other results of alcoholism. And that ego disorder has always made me so obsessed with myself, so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people, so obsessed with how I feel, that in fact for the last several years I have boiled my alcoholism or the base of it down to one sentence, and I think it's valid. The basis of my alcoholism is this: without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world to me. Without divine intervention, I can give a little lip service to something being more important than how I feel. And I may be able to act for just a little while like something's more important than how I feel, but if I haven't done the work to get that divine intervention, that's all a smokescreen. when the chips get down, I'm going to let how I feel be the most important thing in this universe. And the result, a whole lot of results of that ego disorder and that obsession with myself. One of them, of course, has been all my life, that pain and that emptiness that obsession with self creates. And that's been there as far back as I can remember. As far back as I can remember, I've never been able to stand the way I feel inside without either running as hard as I can or getting something in there to try to make me feel good enough that I can stand it. For the last 29 years, these 12 steps and you guys have filled up that emptiness inside and have done something about that pain. But for the first 37 years of my life, I ran toward and to everything I could find to try to put something out. Your applause, your acclaim, the alcohol, you know, everything, people, relationships, whatever. I've often said that if there's a person, a substance, or an activity that I did not use in order to try to fill up that emptiness inside me, I assure you it was an oversight. It was not intentional on my part. That ego disorder, as I said, has had just so many far-reaching effects all my life. It's what robbed me of any teachability or humility. I mentioned earlier that I truly believe that in April of 81, I got the first true teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. And to me, that's very simply defined. It's the willingness to override the veto of my brain and do some things that are suggested, even though I don't understand them, I don't agree with them, I don't think they would work. And every time I say that, from a podium or otherwise, a part of my brain says, "What's wrong with that? Why in the world should an intelligent person do something about their life that they don't understand or they don't agree with or they don't think will work?" In my case, it's real simple. I've got a talking illness. I've had an old crazy picture show rolling in the back of my head all of my life. And my alcoholism has been running its mouth at me all my life. And when my brain is talking to me, if I haven't done what I need to do today to get the divine intervention, that's the same thing as my alcoholism talking to me, because I've got an alcoholic brain. And in all that talking to me that my alcoholism has done, I think the scariest single thing is this: I don't believe it's ever tried to kill me. I've nearly died from alcoholism dozens of times. And what's so frightening is the reason it hasn't tried to kill me is it doesn't care whether I live or die. And my alcoholism doesn't care whether you live or die. My alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing. That's try to get itself another drink. And it'll tell me anything on the face of this earth in order to get it. Something that might kill you, me, or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without ever dropping a stitch. It doesn't care. It'll sling it all up against the wall. Well, I've already told you my recovery has not been that that's gone away. What my recovery has been is that most of the time I can recognize that that's not reality and I don't have to obey it. And I can go ahead and do the next right thing anyway. In fact, very frequently I can laugh at the old crazy picture show going on in the back of my head. I'll tell y'all in a few minutes about a wreck that left me crippled up. If somebody put a pistol in my head right now and said, "Don, if you don't run out of this room, we're going to blow your head off," I'd have to let them blow my head off because I'm crippled, can't run. I'll be standing talking to the same bank teller I've been doing business with for years, maybe talking to her about her children, or she knows I'm in AA and do a lot of traveling, might even be talking to her about a spiritual principle. I will see a stack of $100 bills behind the cage, and it'll go through my head to grab them and run. That doesn't even bother me. I'm not going to do that. I just laugh at that and let the old crazy picture show roll. But the important part of that is most of the time I can recognize that it's not reality, because another one of these heads of this hydra, of this many splendored thing we call alcoholism, if you've been around a month, somebody's probably said that it's a disorder of our perception. If I go to the dictionary and look up the words in that, what I come away with, guys, is I don't see things right. I don't hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So the bottom line for me gets real simple. When I put the final veto in the universe in my little old brain that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it and I agree with it and I think it'll work, with what I've got wrong with me, I just put myself under death sentence. Because I wind up believing one of those deadly lies, and I'll pick up that drink, and I know what'll happen to me. I know where I was in this progression in April 1981. I'll die a mad dog death, and I'll make it to that grave that I missed by days in 1981. Another result of that ego disorder, it's always made me an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something or somebody, and at the same instant, knowing I wasn't nearly good enough for that same person or that same thing. I've always known that I could do anything. And at the same time, I've always known that I couldn't really do anything. And the weird thing is, I've never been aware of that bothering me a whole lot in 66 years, bouncing around with all that diametrically opposed stuff going on. The weird thing is, what I don't believe I've ever one single time been able to feel without divine intervention or before recovery, those things that I substituted for divine intervention, primarily alcohol. What I've never been able one time to feel is just okay for anything or anybody on the face of this earth. Without doing the work I need to do to get the divine intervention, I have no peers. None. I can be above you and I can be below you and I can be both at the same time. But if I haven't done the work I need to do to get my divine intervention, I cannot be your equal. I cannot have you as a peer. So the first 12 or 13 years of my life, what was really going on was trying to stay a half a step ahead of a screaming fit because of all that pain and discomfort and emptiness inside me, trying to keep everything juggled and the bells ringing and the mirrors flashing, the smoke shooting out so you wouldn't see what was here and what wasn't here, and I wouldn't have to stop and look at it and be swallowed up by the earth through that emptiness in my own middle. 12 or 13 years old, I got drunk the first time. First night I got drunk, I got in a lot of trouble. I puked, I blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover. And I swore all those Baptists around there were right and I would never do it again. And not only was I sincere, it was actually fairly effective because it was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And I got drunk the second time after all that pain and of that first drunk for precisely the same reason that I got drunk the next 2,000 times. You see, once I got enough of that stuff in me, it did something about that pain and emptiness inside me. And for the first time in my life, made me feel good enough inside that I could stand the way I felt without either running or trying to stuff anything else in there. Now remember, how I feel is the most important thing in the universe. So my powerlessness over alcohol is not a bit mysterious to me. In fact, it's a no-brainer. It couldn't have been any other way, since that was the only thing that made me feel the way I needed to feel. And how I feel is the most important thing. The bottom line's always been really simple. It didn't matter what it cost, and it didn't matter who it cost, because how I feel is the most important thing in the universe. I'm not going to give you a blow and a drunk log on my drinking career, but I'll tell you a few things about it. It lasted 25 years just about until I got sober. We all have different drinking stories, different drinking patterns, and I'm very aware that it's at least as easy for us to brag about how bad we were as it is for us to brag about how good we are. In fact, I think it's easier. But I want to report to you as honestly as I can what my drinking deal was. I never apologized for it. I never hid it. To the best of my memory, I have never one time in my life told myself or anybody else that I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I never wanted a couple of drinks. A couple of drinks never did anything to me except make me need something to drink real bad. I had the phenomenon of craving the first time I drank alcohol. Nobody ever had to tell me that drinking in the morning would cure a hangover. I was born knowing that in the marrow of my bones. The fact that I didn't drink around the clock from the beginning had nothing to do with ambition or anything noble. It was terror, absolute terror. For most of the mornings of that 25 years that I drank, I would lay in that bed and pieces of the night would come back to me, and terror of what I wasn't ready for that day would overwhelm me. And finally, after laying in the bed and smoking four or five cigarettes, I'd be propelled out of the bed by terror. I'd go in and stick a toothbrush in my mouth and threw up probably half the mornings of my life for 25 years and tried to put on the right clothes and go and make the right noise so that you wouldn't see what I was and what I wasn't and that I wouldn't have to face it. That was what substituted for ambition in me. During that 25 years, I'm very confident I went to bed legally drunk at least 80% of the nights. I had no idea that I was drunk that much because the only standard I ever had for drunk was whether or not I blacked out. If I remembered everything, that discussion was over. I was not drunk, thank you. Now that Kentucky's got that legal limit down to .08, I probably woke up drunk 80% of the mornings. By the time I was in my mid-teens, I knew that if anybody stayed close enough to me long enough, they'd blow the whistle on my drinking. And I also, when you did that, if I couldn't change your mind, you had just punched your ticket out of my life. Now, I didn't say you just punched your ticket out of my life. Probably I said something like, oh, God, what a relief. I'm so glad you brought that up. But what's really going on, if you were going to interfere with the only thing that made me feel the way I needed to feel and how I feel is the most important thing in the universe, if I couldn't change your position, you had to go. So the last 20 years I drank, and I'm not proud of this. I've had to do a lot of amends on account of it, and I think it's a pretty darn good partial description of a sociopath. But the last 20 years I drank, I don't believe I even had people in my life. I had positions, and whatever your position was, I probably had your replacement interviewed at any given time because I knew you were going to blow that whistle on my drinking. It didn't matter how much another part of me needed you, cared about you, or even loved you as best I could. You had to go if you were going to mess with the only thing that made me feel the way I needed to feel. School was really easy for me, and by the time I was 16 years old and just wound up my junior year of high school, on one hand, I was still holding on to things by the fingernails. I tell you, it was a different world in Trigg County, Kentucky in the 1950s than it is today. In today's world, they would have thrown a net over me and gotten me into an asylum before my 14th birthday. But in the 1950s in Trigg County, Kentucky, if you were smart enough, cute enough, and had the right last name, you could get away with murder. And I got away with murder. And at 16, I was still holding on ostensibly to everything, but a part of me knew it was time to get out of Dodge, that things were just about to collapse on account of my drinking. The egomania part, of course, knew that that farm couldn't hold something as hard as I was anyway. So I went and got on a Greyhound bus by myself at 16, went 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville in Kentucky, and kicked around for a couple of days, wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. They gave me a bunch of tests and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And my reaction to that was to stay so drunk the first semester that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just a matter of passing out and coming to. And, of course, I blew the scholarship. So for the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, drank full-time, went to school full-time, and somehow got through undergraduate and law school and don't have a clue how that happened. When I look back on that whole 8 years, it's just a whirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. I don't have a handful of concrete memories of the whole 8 years. In the spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter Dana, who's 42 now, was born. And Dana was my only child for over 20 years. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville. And I've always been a criminal defense lawyer, and I practiced for 10 years, from 68 to 78, with really a good deal of material success, not nearly as much as I used to think I had had. It's amazing how as we stay sober longer, we get a different focus on the past. But I wasn't nearly as close to Dara and Bailey as I thought. But on the other hand, I've always had a knack for getting involved in some cases that had some money and some publicity value in them. And that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested that something was wrong with the way I lived. And as insane as my life was before I started practicing law, during that 10 years, it escalated greatly. It escalated because the disease progresses. It escalated because I had some money to escalate it with. During that 10 years, I began to use a world of things other than alcohol. And I used a world of them. But they were all sad shows. Alcohol was always the big tent. Exactly like they were with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. Everything else was something to change the effect of alcohol. To increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the alcohol was the main event. February 10th of 1978, I'd been practicing law for 10 years, still holding on by my fingernails to things there. At the time, I was remarried to my daughter's mother, and I was mentioning that to somebody right before the meeting started tonight. Please feel free to ignore this. It's not in the big book, and it's my only sociological observation of the evening. But as far as I'm concerned, the fact that I was remarried to the same woman establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. Now, not because there's anything particularly wrong with Dana's mama. It's just that over 29 years sober, I've just kind of observed, and I swear I don't think in the history of the world anybody ever did that but us. I think if a normie even considered jumping in a frying pan that they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum, getting in and try to protect themselves. And we do it routinely, drunk and sober. You know, old Joe and Sue divorced, but they're dating. They'll probably get back together. And the bizarre thing is it works for us sometimes. You know, it's not even necessarily bad. It's just real different from ordinary people. But at any rate, I was remarried to my daughter's mama. Of course, I had a young lady with me who was not my daughter's mama. And I got full of scotch, cocaine, quaaludes, speed, and vodka. I still had a .40 when they got me to the hospital in Nashville, about 70 miles from where I had the wreck. And I drove a Corvette off the road at about 130 miles an hour. Did an awful lot of bad things. My body broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg. They had to do a bypass, take out a vein, grafted in to replace the artery, and separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had what they call a suprapubic catheter, just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. I had a half dozen major surgeries the first year after that wreck. Was in the hospital more than 6 months of that first year. The doctors told me early on that I would never walk again without at least a brace on one leg and maybe both, and probably a cane. And they told me that they were real certain that we'd never find a surgeon who would attempt to put my plumbing back together so I would ever pee again. Just for the record and purely by the grace of God, because we know it wasn't me following directions, I've been sober 29 years and haven't owned a brace or a cane for over 30 years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology at Duke University did put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function, but I didn't know that was going to happen. Now, the wreck was down on the Tennessee line, closer to Nashville and Vanderbilt Hospital than it was Louisville, so that's where they took me for the emergency surgery, and I was there for 6 or 7 weeks and in and out of surgery and always in intensive care. But they didn't know who I was there. They didn't treat me with nearly the appropriate deference. And as soon as I was able to get moved against medical advice to Louisville, I got moved with my entourage to the Louisville hospitals. And I laid in those hospitals up there for months. And every single day, my friends would come in and bring me booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. And nobody ever said a word to me. And I would lay in that hospital bed with that prognosis, and I would say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellows, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And just be, and if your man ought not be out there doing the crime if he's not prepared to do the time. So you guys are not going to hear me whining. Give me another drink and let's go on with it. And that, folks, is real insanity. It is real powerlessness. And it is truly letting how I feel in the instant be the most important thing in the world. More important than my child. More important than my profession. More important than whether I ever walked. More important than whether I ever peed. More important than whether I lived or died. Letting how I live, how I feel in the moment be the most important thing in this world to me. Didn't go broke right away after that wreck. A little law firm had built up around this other guy, myself, so some money came in for a while. Of course, my daughter's mama divorced me, and I wound up married to the young lady who was with me. She was hurt, but not as badly as I. She had on a seatbelt, for God's sake. And about a year after that wreck, I still had the tube. Around the first year of 79, I still had the tube in my belly, my catheter bag, my braces, my crutches, and I made my first trip to the asylum. And I don't use that word to be cute. The big book uses that word, and my mama used that word. When I was a kid in the country, people didn't have substance abuse problems and go to treatment, and people didn't have breakdowns and go to hospitals. People went crazy and got put in asylums. And that's a whole lot more descriptive of what kept happening to me. And by the time I got in that first one, this phenomenon of craving, this physical addiction to alcohol had progressed to the point where I had just physically lost the ability to stop once I started. Something had to intervene and get me prized loose from alcohol. And once it did that, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. Well, they got me in that place. They got me through the 3 or 4 days. They set me up in a chair and had an AA meeting. Somebody read the steps. They got to step 3 and got talking something about turning my will and my life over to some kind of God. Well, of course that insulted my intelligence. So I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And then I hobbled on the telephone and called somebody to get me away from you religious fanatics before you somehow polluted my pristine intellect. Well, that was somewhere around the first year of 79. I got sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81. I really don't remember much of that 2.5 years. Some things that I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times in that 2.5 years. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie, and I'm real grateful for that. It was just an adjunct of my alcoholism, but it brought enough legal and otherwise pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I had founded. And I proved that I wasn't going to make the decision at its bottom. And don't kid yourself, bottom's not an accident. It's not, I don't even think it involves grace most of the time. Bottom's not something that just happens. Bottom's a decision. And we've got control of it. And until we understand that powerless over alcohol does not mean powerless over our elbow, and until we understand that these folks in Alcoholics Anonymous cannot knock a drink out of our hand, and the God that they're talking about will not knock a drink out of our hand, we ain't going to get it. Because I could not have lived if I hadn't have finally surrendered to the fact that I had to do the first mature things I'd ever done in my life. Not do some things that I thought I was going to burst and splatter all over the wall if I didn't do them. And do some things that I thought I might burst and splatter all over the wall if I had to do them. But at any rate, I wasn't going to make the decision at its bottom as long as I had a wristwatch. I certainly wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. Right after the guys kicked me out of the law firm, my law license got jerked. My new wife had to leave me during that period on account of my insanity. She was staying with some girlfriends during that period and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on my only child in January of 1980, and I didn't see or talk to Dana again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my portion of the office building we'd built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that. The mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was just all gone. And for almost a year up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. I had a head full of information about AA. You see, a good half of those 18 places I was in had treatment programs based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have any place to go between trips to the asylum, sometimes I'd go to a world of meetings. So I had a wealth of information about Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, it is one of my frequent and sincere prayers right today that I don't ever know as much about AA as I did before I could get sober. And I mean that with all my heart. And what would happen during that time is one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain, my alcoholism, same thing, would go, yeah, I know it works for you guys, but you don't know how special my case is. My goodness, you don't understand how intelligent I am, and the stage I played on has just been so broad, and my tentacles have just touched so many. And my God, I see things more clearly than ordinary people, and I feel them so much more acutely that I'm wounded by my own understanding. And I would frequently get teary-eyed, so grateful it would work for the simple-minded. But you all didn't understand that in my case. Of course I knew I was an alcoholic, for that matter, a dope fiend too. But my God, those were just little symptoms or results of the real problem. The real problem was so much more complex and magnificent and terrible than that, that I couldn't babble about your myth of a higher power and go to your little group therapy sessions you call meetings and concentrate on the little thing of drinking and drugging and expect this terrible, magnificent thing to go away. So, alas, it wouldn't work for me because I was too magnificent. And here's a real nightmare. The very next minute, one of you would tell me how it saved your life, changed your life, and that same brain would go, yeah, I know it works for you guys, but you don't know how bad I am. You don't know about the parts of me that are just missing and always have been. You don't know that I've never really been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself. You don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my life. Anything in my life that even looked okay, much less good, was some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and for. You don't know how bad I've been. I've destroyed everything and scorched the earth behind me. If by some miracle I did stay sober for a couple of months, it'd just be to be blown into by a sawed-off shotgun, or at the very best, spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible. Very next minute is telling me it won't work for me because I'm so great and I'm believing it both times. Fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of asylum number 17 in Nashville, Tennessee. They let me in. I found out later because they didn't think I would live a week if they left me on the street. I had, of course, no home, no car, no clothes. Teeth were rotting out of my head. Stayed in there a month. It was time to bounce me out of that place. Had no place to go. My roommate was a very young fella, and his family lived in Nashville, beautiful people. And they felt sorry for me and said, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days? Let's try to figure out what to do with you. I went and lived with him a year. And the first 6 months, I didn't stay straight, but I got better. And I believe I had to get better before I could grab hold of the program. When I was 2 or 3 months into my sobriety, I'm talking about 2 or 3 months after April of 81, I was still trying to recapture the art of using a knife and fork on food. I remember night after night going from the Shoney's or from the 202 Club in Nashville to the Shoney's down the street, and I would sit there with that knife and fork under the table watching my friends. I guess I was just embarrassed to say, excuse me, Jimmy, I seem to have lost the ability to use these. Could you give me a few tips? So I was convinced that the best I could ever hope for in my life would be to be on Social Security disability or maybe be able to hold some sort of minimum wage job. I remember 2 or 3 months sober sitting in a discussion meeting, and it hit me for the first time that I might stay sober for a long time. And then my brain started going wild, that someday I might be able to have a furnished room of my own where I could read a book or maybe even have a cat. And that terrified me so much, so scared to think my life could ever get that good, that I literally remember breaking out in a cold sweat sitting in that meeting. But at any rate, I believed I had to get better before I could grab hold of recovery. And during that 6 months from the fall of 80 into the spring of 81, I did. I went to a world of meetings, most of them at that 202 Club in Nashville, Tennessee. I got to where I could go 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped, and that was a world record for me in or out of the asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. And how I really know I got better is that they only put me back in a rubber room one time in that whole six-month period. And the rate I'd been going twice a year in the asylum looked like the picture of mental health. late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk, and it was another one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks, and I have truly drunk a barrel of both those things, and this is not a joke. I have better memories of the Listerine than of that old hot pop-off. But on this most recent drunk, I was drinking and taking everything that I could find. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville. And that was when a loving God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, it's really important for me to tell you, I didn't know I had any gifts. I didn't know there was any such thing as a loving God. Coming off that last drunk didn't feel any different than the 200 before it. I hadn't seen a burning bush yet. I've seen about 1,000 that were smoking some, but I've never seen one in full conflagration. Now, those 1,000 that I've seen that were smoking, about 998 of them, I've gone, oh, my God, that's life-changing. That is an epiphany. That is the key. Hadn't done anything about it. 2 or 3 weeks later, I don't even remember the thing. 2 or 3 of them, I got out my bellows. If any of you young folks don't know what that is, it's something you blow air on a fire with. I got out my bellows, and I started treating those smoking bushes like they were burning bushes. And I started acting like they were burning bushes, and I started doing the action. And the first thing you know, those couple of bushes burst into flame, and they became burning bushes. Of course, first thing comes to an alcoholic's mind is the H word, hypocrisy. You know, we don't mind past adultery, larceny, and so on, but my God, we don't want to be hypocrites. Let me tell you what I think about that. Bill Wilson had something happen in that hospital room. Bill didn't know whether it was a visitation from the angel Gabriel or it was his synapses misfiring on account of withdrawal. Dr. Silkworth comes in. Bill tells him about it. Dr. Silkworth same way said, I don't know either, Bill. But he said, if I were you, I would hold on to it because it's got to be better than what you had. So Bill got out his bellows and he started giving it air and he started treating that night in the hospital room like it was a burning bush and it became a burning bush. I don't know how I got off on that track, but where I was in April of 81, I didn't feel any different. If I'd kept waiting until all of a sudden it had just opened up, and oh my God, I see it, and Alcoholics Anonymous is the answer for me. And I think, feel, and believe this is right. If I'd kept waiting for that to happen, I would have been rotting in that pauper's grave for way over 29 years. The biggest gift my God had given me, my loving God, had given me the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. Had no idea I had it. 3 or 4 days after that last drink, I stumbled back to the door of the 202 Club. I didn't think they would let me in, and they really should not have let me in. In today's environment, they would not have. I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. They had caught me shooting dope in the men's room. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through the clubhouse and a big old boy about 6'6", that Jerry may have met, by the name of Joe Wall. Joe's dead now. Joe walked up and looked down at me and said, Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program. And I thought he was giving me a compliment. My knee-jerk reaction was, well, thank God they have finally figured out who they're dealing with. But Joe went on and he said, and you know, that's a real shame because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal and we bury you buttholes all time. And that felt like an icy hand closing over something inside of me. And it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door and they did let me in. And I remember exactly what was said and who said it. They said, yeah, Don, come on in. You're keeping us sober. And I said, well, y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I won't live. And they said, sure, don't drink, don't take dope, go to meetings. By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, I clearly remember that I didn't want to go to any of those meetings. I clearly remember that you all were still obviously religious fanatics. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody for God's sake. But I'd been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had of being able to turn around to my brain and say, yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another, and we don't have anything left to do but go to these dumb old meetings. Although they can't possibly solve our unique problems. And here's the sunshine, the gospel, the good news. I had it all backwards. And I had the same thing backwards that I will always have backwards right today without divine intervention. I'll make it all about what I think, feel, and believe. I'll make that reality. In nature, it does not occur to me to go ahead and do the right thing when I don't feel like doing it. If I don't feel like doing it, I want to call up Hilda or Ralph or somebody and or Dick, and I don't feel like going to work. What can we do to get me fixed so I feel like doing right? Well, if you're an alcoholic of my type, I'm getting ready to give you some horrible news. In 29 years, I have prayed until I was blue in the face for God to fix me inside so I would feel like doing the right thing. I have dominated discussion meetings about it. I've probably done, if we had them all here stacked up, I've probably done 2 feet of inventory writing on it. After I got back to practice law and had some money, I spent some money on outside counseling, going to get me fixed so I would feel like doing the right thing and so I could do it. And here's the bad news. Not one time in 29 years has anything made me feel like doing right except going on and doing right when I don't feel like it. And that is just almost more maturity than I can absolutely stand. But at any rate, the good news was I had it backwards. See, I thought in order for those meetings to work, I had to believe it would work. I thought it had to feel like it was working. In fact, I thought you had to be able to see the causal connection of A causing B. None of that had anything to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting and let my old sick soul and brain get dragged in there behind the raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. And I said, I've read it several times. And they said, we know. You've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying, dummy. They said, you've got it in your head that book is some sort of philosophy book. There's something there you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety. They said, pardon, it ain't going to happen. Said, in the first place, the big book is not the solution to your alcoholism. And I said, wait a minute. You've been telling me for 2.5 years that that big book is the solution to my alcoholism. They said, no, we haven't. We have been telling you that the action described in that book is the solution to your alcoholism. They said, don't believe this crap about recovery being a learning process. They said, you got to learn about that much. And they said, Don, in your case, you've had enough information about recovery for over 2 years to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life without learning one single new piece of information about AA. They said, what's killing you is not what you know and don't know, dummy. It's what you're doing and not doing. And what the book really is a simple instruction manual for your actions. And what recovery is a doing process, not a learning process. They said, if you want to live, you better come back to this book like a little child and try to act like you've never laid eyes on it before and start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the black part, not interpreting, memorizing, or arguing with anything, and not looking for anything to learn, but looking for what it says to do. And that's when they explain that the steps are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That I'd be a member of this fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking, and thank God there's no other requirement. But if I grab hold of this fellowship, like a parasite really, without getting into the AA program, which is in the 12 steps, I might stay dry a week, or some people seem to stay dry 30 years. But if I do it that way, I'll have no healing of what's really wrong, of that disordered ego, of that inability to be comfortable inside myself. That healing only comes through doing steps 1 through 9 the way the book says do them. And then having done that, living every day of my life by doing the action that is the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Thank God my daily reprieve is not contingent on my spiritual condition. If it were contingent on my spiritual condition, that would mean it was contingent on how I am. And some days I am not very good, guys. Some days I still wake up with the brain spinning, you know, scared and obsessed with something. Try to pray, can't remember the last word. I just tried to pray. Seems like to me I'm cut off from you. I'm cut off from God. I don't want to go to a meeting. I don't want to read meditation books. Don't want to do any of this crap. But thank God, the maintenance of my spiritual condition is all action. And the difference is the difference between turning that light switch back there on and off. Because if my reprieve is contingent on how I am, I can't do anything about that immediately. I'm powerless immediately about how I am. But as far as what I do today, the action that is the maintenance of my spiritual condition, I've got 100% control of it. And regardless of how I feel, what I'm thinking, or what I believe that day, if I do that action, that book promises me that I'll get my daily reprieve and I won't put alcohol in me that day and I won't wake up that monster inside me and that phenomenon of craving and I won't die that mad dog death as long as I do that action. But at any rate, they explained to me that the steps are the prescription for alcoholism. That they work on alcoholism just like an antibiotic or penicillin works on an infection. If I've got an infection that's going to kill me if it's not treated, but will respond to penicillin, I don't need to understand the origin, the nature, and the breadth of my infection. I don't need to aggravate the medical profession and my friends to death about trying to discover all those things about my infection. I don't need to understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. I don't even need to believe that that little bottle of pills can take care of all these terrible things wrong with magnificent me. And the real kicker is I don't even need to want to take the pills. If I've got the infection and take the pills as directed, that's very important, I'll get just fine, thank you. And these steps, I was told in my experiences, taught me work on alcoholism exactly the same way. What I think about them, what I believe, haven't got a thing to do with it. If I'll go through there like a little child and do that action, I'll be just fine, thank you. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and night. Man, I really went wild then. I remember, in fact, I was in Nashville a couple months ago, went and stood in the same place in 2OT where I'd sat on an old saggy couch and cried when I explained to them that the second step was what's killing me. That I'd been trying for 2.5 years to change what I thought, felt, and believed, and I couldn't change a thing. So I'm sitting there with tears running down my face telling them how I had to die. And I finally was given ears to hear them when they said, Don, you've got that backwards too. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. And my mouth probably fell open because remember, that's the center of my universe, what I think, feel, and believe. They said, why no, son? Said, we would never do that. Said, you are far too ill to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. They said, in the second place, the issue of whether you live or die will be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, believe won't have a thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, you better get down on your knees, start saying those words, and don't worry about what's going through your head because it won't count. Having no idea why I was doing it, I know now that it was that wonderful gift from God. But sometime in April of 81, I started getting on my knees every morning, every night, 100% acting as if embarrassed. Sure, it wouldn't work, but I started doing it every morning, every night, and the miracle of the second step began to happen. I began to come to believe. As far as I know, I haven't missed a morning or night since, and that's a lot of thousands of mornings and nights. But I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. I'm telling you for a different reason. Probably at least half the times I hadn't wanted to get down there. Whole bunch of times, I could have gotten a written medical excuse. I didn't feel like getting down there. Been a lot of mornings that I described earlier where the old brain's spinning when I get down there. I can't remember the last word. I just tried to pray. Seems perfectly obvious to me that it can't be doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning, every night. Something's worked every single day. And it's the second most important thing in my sobriety. I tell you, I'm not a dictatorial sponsor. I don't tell people they have to do anything. But I do tell the guys that I sponsor, please don't ask me to give you any hints about how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and night, because I have no idea how to do that. I've been totally unable to do that. I have no experience with staying sober without getting on my knees every morning and every night. They led me through the steps in Nashville, and I have run my mouth here, and I'm going to... Lee, how much time we got? All right. Well, we're in better shape than I thought it was. And by the way, if any of y'all get done for I do, y'all please feel free to leave. I'll leave when I'm done. But they led me through the steps in Nashville, got me to the third step, finally got it through my head that that's just a decision. It's also an action step. Either I've gone in a room with an understanding person, because we have always got an understanding person now, and I've said the third step prayer and meant for that to be the watershed moment when I tried to stop doing it my way and started trying to do it God's way, when I committed to do the rest of the steps and quit trying to figure out the patterns. And understand that when I'm trying to figure out the patterns of my life and see without divine intervention, we're talking 180 degrees here. Because without divine intervention, I will approach everything in every area of my life. Let me figure out this pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. I'm 66 and ain't figured one out right yet. When I'm trying to figure out the patterns of my life, I'm worse off than a chimpanzee trying to master quantum physics. I simply don't have the capacity to do it. My job is stitching. And I believe with all my heart that there's a little spark of the divine in me and every other human being that knows God's will only in the right now. Only in the absolute right now. And when my brain's spinning and telling me that if I take that stitch there, I'll lose something or won't get something, or worst of all, I'll look bad, because, you know, alcoholics are truly more afraid of that usually than we are dying of looking bad. But if I'm willing to take that stitch in the right place, it works. Then they led me through the fourth and fifth step. I did that, formed a picture of what a spiritual dawn ought to look like. It was at my request that Katie read Step 6 and 7 from the big book tonight, because I went home, just like the book said, after did my fifth step, spent an hour going through the first five steps, did my sixth and seventh step, thought that was where, with God's help, I went to work on me to make me into what I had decided a spiritual dawn ought to look like. And I went right on thinking I'd done 6 and 7. As a byproduct of steps 8 and 9, my amends steps at about a year and a half so when my law license got put back in order, went back to Louisville in January of 83, 21 months sober, terrified. If I could have found a minimum wage job in Nashville, I would never have gone back to Louisville to practice law. And I'll tell you what, I don't think there was any paranoia in that. I think my reasons for going back to Louisville were not wanting to go back to Louisville were extremely sound. I believe a loving God poured oil on the troubled waters of my past to keep the worst of that from coming up to bite me. But I went back, second month I was in town, January of 83, by God incidents. A speaker got snowed in and they put me up in front of 2,000 people at the Kentucky State Convention to tell my story. They put my story without my last name on the front page of the Louisville paper the next day. People started saying nice things to me. Don, will you speak here? Will you be my sponsor? Will you do this? First thing you know, I'm making a little money. I'm driving a decent car. I'm wearing decent clothes. There wasn't a bank, by the way, in Louisville that would take a checking account from me when I got back. I had to use a wealthy man in the program's influence across the river in southern Indiana to get a little independent bank to take a checking account with my name on it. The forgiveness of non-alcoholics for us when we try to do the right thing is absolutely amazing. Some of those same banks have extended unsecured lines of credit to me that not only are embarrassing, they're very unwise on their part. But the forgiveness is unbelievable. But at any rate, that same month, February of 1983, I saw my daughter Dana for the first time in over 3 years. 2 months later, she moved in with me, lived with me all through high school. And by the way, we just firmed up the airline reservations today. A few months ago, I got asked to go to Russia and the Ukraine, Rick, to do the 12 steps through an interpreter. And my daughter lived in Russia a while and is fluent in Russian. She's been in Al-Anon over 20 years, and she's going with me. And she could do the Al-Anon part without an interpreter. And the first thing you know, everything's going great. I shared with Jerry today something I don't usually share, but if you're having trouble financially in early sobriety, when I was 3.5 years sober, my sponsor and my lawyer had a conference call. And we decided that things had improved enough that I could file bankruptcy without getting indicted. So it took me 3.5 years sober to work up the bankruptcy. And the bankruptcy I filed was a Chapter 11 with a plan to pay back 100 cents on the dollar. My credibility was so great, the creditors litigated it 4 years before they approved a plan to pay back 100 cents on the dollar. So in April of 1996, when I was 50, the month I was 15 years sober, I made the last payment on the financial wreckage of my past. First 9 years of my sobriety truly were, they were magic, they were wonderful. But first 9 years of my sobriety, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me, like to have beat me to death. My God, I was working on them so hard. I really was. And by this time, 9 years sober, I'd been speaking all over the country for a while, and I was sponsoring probably 40, 50 men. You know, it's kind of embarrassing for a spiritual giant where you, some woman pays a little attention to you, and if she would have had a bit of trouble in the world getting a job haunting a house on the weekend, I would forthwith, tearfully, profess undying love and would have passed any lie detector test on earth. And then about a week later, I'd wake up and think, if I don't get away from her now, I'm going to die. You know, if I don't get away right now, and, you know, you keep doing that repetitively, it's hard to reconcile with your spiritual gianthood. And the more money I would make, the worse the financial chaos would get. Some things happened in May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober that caused me to start looking at 6 and 7 entirely differently. I could have quoted the 7th step prayer to you backwards, but I didn't realize. It wasn't real to me what it really means. I didn't realize that it didn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. And it certainly does not ask God to remove the ones that I had decided when I did my 4th and 5th step, because that's just another self-determined objective. Me dressing it up in spiritual clothing or psychological clothing or what else doesn't change its nature. It's a self-determined objective. And it certainly doesn't say that I ask God to remove the ones that are making my self-centered butt uncomfortable. For 9 years, I did not understand that when I'm praying for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone, I might as well be praying for a bright red Ferrari. I'm praying for my own selfish ends. And it turned out 6 and 7 are not where I start working on myself with God's help. It's where I stop working on myself. It's where I start trying to stop taking care of me and let God take care of me. It's where I start trying to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. It's where in my relationship with Sharon, I start praying to love, comfort, and understand her. I stop acting out my agendas. I don't have a button to push or a switch to flip to make my brain stop having its agendas. I can't make myself feel like a spiritual giant, but I make myself act like a fellow that believed that would act. And I found out that I get all the benefits of it when I act. Some very shortly after May of 1990, Sharon and I started dating, and I just prayed to love, comfort, and understand her. It's the only trick I used on her. And that, by the way, is magic in human relations. I have discovered that if any part of me is trying to get you to love, comfort, and understand me, it's a spiritual absolute law that I will not be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. Absolute law. And by the way, love, comfort, and understanding includes things like respect and my rights, because it masquerades a lot of different ways in my way. But if I'm trying to get you to do it, it ain't going to happen. If you do exactly what I thought I wanted you to do before you're done, I'll change it. So the only way it's possible for me to feel loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction is when I'm praying to love, comfort, and understanding you. Same spiritual paradox. The question, what am I getting out of this, is the wrong question. Because if I ask that question and contemplate it about 20 seconds, the answer will be not enough. The right question is, what can I bring to this? Same paradox. That's the only time that I can get it, what I feel like I need to get out of anything. God's so much better lawyer than I am. When I go down there and try to outthink, outperform, outmaneuver, do well on my cases, win cases, make money, protect myself, cover my butt, I wind up in the snake pit every single time. Every single time. But when I go down there and try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to, things that happen are just unbelievable. The bar association that I disgrace so much calls me up and says, Don, be sure and come to the bar dinner. We're going to make you pro bono lawyer of the year. They call me up. They say, hey, Don, why don't you come over here and sit on the citizens, better judges, interview people who want to be judges, pass or whether they're qualified. Then they say, Don, why don't you be chair of that? Then they say, hey, you know, in of court here, we really need a little drunken criminal lawyer to sit here with state Supreme Court justices, Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the richest, most powerful lawyers and judges in Kentucky. Then they call me up and say, Don, we've got an opening on the Ethics Committee. My goodness, God has a sense of humor. And the bottom line is this on 6 and 7. What it is stopping trying to fix myself, stopping praying for God to remove things, because I see now that God uses, God's molding things that I can't see. And those character defects that were so painful and so embarrassing deep into sobriety are the very core of what I've got to offer today. See, I never know. I need to just keep taking that stitch like a little child and let God lead me where God would lead me. And when that happens, here's the bottom line, and I want to close. You're all thinking that, thank God. But I want to basically close with this. If in May of 1990, when I was 9 years sober, if I had made a list of what I thought was the best I could have in every area of my life, my relationship, Sharon and I have such a beautiful relationship. We don't argue. I sponsor some guys that are counselors and psychologists. And they tell me it's not healthy to have a relationship where you don't argue. And I tell them they are welcome to their healthy relationships. I'm just going to wallow in my illness. Sharon and I are doing just fine. But if I'd made that list and given it to God, and God had said, Don, I'm sick of your whining. I'm going to give you everything you've asked for. I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to come as a little child and quit trying to worry about taking care of me and try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. What God's got in store for me is more beautiful than anything I could imagine. I love every one of you. Thank you so much for the love you've shown Sharon and me this weekend, and it's just beautiful to be here. Thank you.